talked about uniform convergence today, then there's no class on Wednesday. The next Monday, I want to apply uniform convergence to power series. So an important thing you can do with, say, a Taylor series where it converges is take derivatives and integrals term by term, just like it's a big polynomial. And understand how that works. It's important that this power series converges uniformly. So you have to climb up the abstraction hierarchy a little bit here. We've talked about sequences of reals, and we have integrals of functions. Now you want to think about things like sequences of functions and sequences of integrals of functions. And you have to build up the useful ideas of those concepts out of our earlier concepts. And I'll start with some examples of that. There's some notes here. Okay. I'll show you an example of a sequence of functions where in the limit we lose continuity, and then another one where in the limit the integral changes, and not to the limit of the integral, but to something totally different. So that's how things will start. Did you all want to ask me any questions related to earlier days or anything you've encountered with the homework or stuff you read in the book somewhere? Use a different letter for every function. So now we use subscripts. Okay, so a whole sequence of functions. And each one of these functions is going to be relatively simple. It's going to go from the unit interval 0, 1, including endpoints, and it's going to map into the same thing. And the definition of each function is very simple. For function gn, all you do is take an input and take its nth power. Very simple functions, and they're all continuous. In fact, they are all differentiable. In fact, you can differentiate them as many times as you want. They're just polynomials. Another function that's related to these. The idea is you want to be able to take the pointwise limit. Okay. What does the pointwise limit mean? Well, for any x, you can consider just that one point and input it into all the functions, and then you'll get a whole sequence of numbers. So you can turn a sequence of functions into a sequence of numbers by just plugging in points into each function. Simplest thing to do is plug in the same point into every function. x, you can form a sequence of numbers. So, and you have to think about what happens to this sequence. It's kind of helpful to make a graph, right? So here's g1, and g2 is a parabola. g3 is part of a cubic. And you can start to guess what's going to happen. Right? You always, whenever you plug in 1, you're just taking the limit of gn of 1. So that would just be 1 to the n. And 1 to the n is just 1. So that's just a sequence of many, many 1s. So the limit is just 1. What happens to these other numbers? All the other numbers are smaller than 1. As the graph suggests, if you look at any fixed x, say here, right, and then you look at x, x squared, x cubed, you get a sequence of points that goes down to 0. Because right, you're taking a number smaller than 1 and taking bigger and bigger powers. Pointwise limit function is not continuous at the end. It's 0 and then it's got a point up at 1. Concept here of taking the limit at each point separately. This has a name, right? Now, of course, in general, the limit of a sequence might not exist, right? But if it does exist, then we can talk about the limit of the functions at that point. Really the limit of the function's values at that point. So we say let g be the pointwise limit of the sequence of these simple monomial functions there. Or if you want to get really concise, you might write something really short like this. You might just write, let gn, then you put an arrow to indicate converge g. And then to indicate how it's converging, you might write a little symbol here like p for pointwise or something like that. Let g be the pointwise limit of the gn's, or let the gn's converge pointwise to gn's. If such a g exists, it's unique, because if a limit of a sequence exists, it's unique. So pointwise limits, right? The limit of these nice smooth curves can lead to a discontinuity. Continuity of these functions was not preserved by the pointwise limits. Thank you. And the functions were very nice, too. They were, not only were they continuous, they were bounded, the domain was bounded, the domain was an interval. But even under very nice additional assumptions, a pointwise limit of continuous function might not be continuous. Thank you. It might not be so bad in terms of, oh, it's just one point. There's only one bad point of discontinuity. But you could make it much worse. If you wanted to be, you know, really, there are tricky examples where you can actually make it discontinuous everywhere. Basically, you have this kind of concept here where something smooth becomes, you know, steeper and steeper and more like a spike and then a vertical jump in the limit. You could have a whole bunch of copies of spikes in more and more places. And you could start out with just one spike with the first function, but if it's smoothed out, and then you can draw a rough picture. You know, I can imagine something much worse. You know, you'd have something like this, maybe. So you could start out with, you know, maybe there's a bump there, and this would be a worse thing. And then in version two, you still have that bump, but you start to make it steeper and narrower, and then you could add, say that all these bumps have peak height one, then you add a second bump somewhere. Right. That could be your H2. And then for an H3, now you could have the same two bumps, and only you'll make them even skinnier and steeper, and then you add a third bump somewhere. So I keep that original bump, but now I make it steeper like this, and make the other one steeper too, really steep. You can still have them have a smooth, you know, top, right? They can have a horizontal tangent at the top. It just gets to be a narrow and narrower. It can be technically smooth at the top, but very, very narrow, right? So these things can just get worse and worse, but of course it gets harder and harder to draw. And you can try and make a, like that. So you can add more and more peaks, and the peaks get steeper and steeper. And you can keep the location, you know, of those peaks constant, right? So this could be, I don't know, P1 for the first peak, and that's always where that peak will always be there, and always at the same height. And then you could, and you'd always maintain that second peak and that third peak, and keep going. And then, you know, you can't do them all. You don't want to do them all in order. What you actually want is to have something kind of jumbled like this. You know, maybe there's my P1, P2, P3. Then I start going back and filling in P4, P5, P6, P7. I can have the order all jumbled up. You know, P9. So say I'm at H9. Now I have 9 peaks. So by the time I get to that stage, what happens is then I've got peaks here. Gets pretty hard to draw, as I said. So each of these peaks would be up there, and it would be a super narrow peak. I'm not very good at drawing it, apparently. So the peaks get narrower and narrower and more numerous. And try to make, actually, have the valleys, you know, get, since it's steeper, have it go ahead and go all the way down to the bottom, right, as you get later in the sequence. And the idea is to have these peaks fill in,
for every gap between the peaks, you eventually fill it in to make that gap smaller. And so the peaks get more and more numerous, closer and closer together. One way to make sure this gets sufficiently bad in the limit is you have these p sub, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc., have them be a listing of all the rational numbers between 0 and 1 or something like that. And that way, eventually, between any two reals, you'll eventually get a peak, right? So you can have, you can arrange that limit of h sub n of x, it looks like this. If it's one of the peaks, say, so maybe the peaks are all the rational numbers. Right? You could, because you can list all the rational numbers. You can start with 1, 0, a half, 1/3, 2/3, 1/4, and you already did 2/4, then 3/4, 1/5, 2/5, 3/5, 4/5, 1/6, you already did 2/6, you already did 3/6, you already did 4/6, 5/6, 1/7, 2/7, 3/7, 4/7, 5/7, 6/7. You could list all the rationals between 0 and 1 in the sequence. So you could have all the peaks happen there, and you could make the peaks steeper and steeper, so that anywhere there wasn't a peak, in the limit, you would make it drop down to closer and closer to zero in the limit. Kind of like how here, everything that wasn't on the far right peak dropped down to zero in the limit. So you can make it really, really bad. Not just one discontinuity. And this function, let's call it H. Since I called the individual functions of the sequence hn. So you have an h pointwise limit of hn's. Okay, so you can have each hn continuous. Everywhere on the whole set from 0 to 1. But H here is not continuous anywhere. Because for any point, there'll be rational points close to it, where the value of the function is 1, and also irrational points close to it, where the value of the function is 0. And so there's no, you can't approach your upper limit will be one, because you can get close to the function with rational. You can get close to a point x. I'm going to use a c. You can get close to a point c with rational points, and so the upper limit will be one, because that'll be the best upper bound you can ever get on deleted neighborhoods of C. And the best lower bound you'll get will be 0, because there'll always be irrational points close to but not equal to C, just like there are rational points close to but not equal to C. So the upper and lower limit will be different. So the limit doesn't exist anywhere. So you can make things really bad with pointwise limits of supposedly nice, that is, continuous or even differentiable functions. So even differentiable. If you want to be really fancy and try and make the force of this, problem even stronger, you could even arrange for the H's to be polynomials. Very complicated polynomials, but you could actually do that. So you could get them to be not just continuous or even differentiable, you could get them to be polynomials and still produce this in the limit. So pointwise limits can be very bad. Same thing happens with, say, an integral. So let's say we have a function. Well, of course, a whole sequence of functions like this. And since I'm interested in the integral, not the derivative, I'm not going to worry about making it smooth. So I just want to give you a simple formula to make the integral simple. So g will be three continuous functions pasted together. So I'm going to call them alpha n, beta n, gamma n. So what are these functions? I need each of these to be continuous, so when I paste it together, it's continuous, okay? Okay, so the first part will be from 1 to n. The second part will be from 0 to 1 over n. And the second part is 1 over n to 2 over n. The last part is from, say, 2 over n to 1. So I think we'll start this sequence at 2. Because otherwise this interval will be empty. And basically, you'll see what I want. This last one is just a constant function. The first two are more interesting. So what we're going to have is a triangular peak, okay? At 1 over n, we will go straight up to make the vertex of the triangular peak. And the height of the vertex of this triangle will be n. So we're going to make a right isosceles triangle like that. Height n. So then the area of the triangle will be 1/2 base times height, right? So base of 2n times n. So that's just 1. Okay, so as n is large, this will be a very skinny but very tall triangle, but the area will always be 1. And I can give you a formula to make it happen, right? So you want to go from 0, 0 in Cartesian coordinates to 1 over n, comma n. Okay? So you can figure it out with slope-intercept form now, because you know the intercept, you know the slope, at least for the left side of the triangle. Right? What's the slope of this line? What's the slope of that line? If I go from 0, 0 to 1 over n, n, my slope is... too easy?
So 1 over n?
No. Rise over run. What's the rise?
1 over run.
The rise is n. The y-coordinate goes up by n. The run, the x-coordinate... Is the x-coordinate increases by 1 over n. So n divided by 1 over n is?
n squared.
Yeah, okay. So, and of course, the y-intercept is a 0, right? When x is 0, y is 0. So here you want n squared times x. So you need that to be your slope. And you need a y-intercept of 0. Right? So just n squared. And then over here, the way to think about it, you can, figure out, okay, I have this point down here, 2 over n, 0, and then you can figure out, okay, given 2 points, you can use the point slope formula, right? Because we know the slope over here will be negative n squared now. So we could use point slope formula to figure this one out. I think it's more fun to do it geometrically, though. The geometric way to think about it is to say, okay, I've got a point x over here, we want to think about x's in here. So here's an x, okay? And it has some height, then that gives us a corresponding, what I'm calling beta n of x, okay? So I could figure out that height by just taking the mirror image. Okay? So if I take the mirror image, this distance right here will get reflected to that distance over here. So the distance right there is just 2 over n minus x. So I'm going to get the same distance over there. Okay? But we're going from 0 to 2 over n minus x, so that means the point I'm at must be 2 over n minus x, so the height would have to be alpha n. Right, that was my function for the left part of the triangle. But now I plug in 2 over n minus x. So if you want to reflect about 1 over n, you have to turn x into 2n minus x. And if you use these 2 points and you use the point slope formula, you will get something equal to that after moderate rearrangement of the terms. Now, if you then integrate these, you could actually prove using an integral, right, that you do get 1, right? And of course, this thing, you integrate that, you'll always get 0, right? So if we do the whole integral of this, although the function does get n high, altogether we're just going to get area 1. As we talked about last time, you can break up an integral. So I'll break up this one into 3 parts. Of course, you already knew that. Last time we actually proved it. Right? And of course, we proved the fundamental theorem of calculus, right? So you could just take antiderivatives if you really want to get your hands dirty, so to speak. Right? The antiderivative of this one would be, one antiderivative of this one, the simplest one, is this one. It's just x squared over 2. I'm looking too hard here. I was thinking of the last one. And then here, you'd have 2nx, I think. Right? N squared times 2 over n is 2n, which has antiderivative 2nx, minus that antiderivative again. And then finally here, 0, the simplest antiderivative is 0, is 0. So you get that by the fundamental theorem of calculus. And this is going to work out to 1 after you simplify enough stuff. For instance, this term here, you plug in 1 over n. But here, you're going to plug in 1 over n to that and subtract it. So that means you'll end up with, okay, so from the first term, I guess if I try not to stick it all, you would have Okay, plug in 1 over n, you'll get a half. Plug in 0, you get 0. This one's a little more delicate. Let's see, 2 over n plugged in here. Okay, the n's will cancel. You'll get 4 minus, 2 over n. So the n squares will cancel you out, but 2 squared, so minus 4 over 2. And then you have to plug in 1 over n and take the difference, right? So you'll get just 2 there minus, the n squareds will cancel again, and you'll get minus a half. And then plus, finally, 0 minus 0. It should come out to 1. Let's see here. 4 minus 2 is 2, minus 2 is 0. Minus minus a half is a half, plus the other half. Yeah, it's 1. So just like the geometry said it should be.
Any questions or comments about that setup? So this is similar to the earlier examples, in that there's as n increases, we have a peak that's getting steeper and steeper, right? Slope n squared. The difference is that now I have the peak moving. Also, the peak is getting taller. Where the peak is over 1 over n, and that 1 over n is going to be moving towards 0 as n increases. And also the height of the peak is going to increase. But all the integrals are equal to 1, okay? So that's the point. But in the limit, I claim the integral will be 0. So in the limit of the sequence of integrals, you would just get 1. But if you take the limit of the functions pointwise and then integrate that, I claim you'll get 0. Because I claim that the pointwise limit of the gn is just the 0 function. Okay. The reason being, the 2 over n here, where the triangle ends, the 2 over n is going to 0 as n goes ever larger. So eventually, for any fixed number x, eventually x will be to the right of 2 over n, right? Because the 2 over n might start way over here, but as n gets bigger, the 2 over n gets smaller. Eventually it'll pass any given x. Right. This x is here now, but maybe by the time we get to 2 over 2n, say, then the triangle will start over there, and then the function will make the x 0, because after the triangle, the function is just 0.
And take a picture, and then we can...
It's hard for me to write down the whole... movie I kind of described there, or even to draw it, but we can make a very rough sketch of the idea. Spend a fair amount of time on some examples before I can actually tell you about uniform convergence, because I want you to see what kind of problems uniform convergence was introduced to solve. Okay. Just like there was continuity and uniform continuity, why would people introduce another concept and increase the overall complexity of the subject? Well, you need uniform continuity to understand why continuous functions are Riemann integrable.
That's the problem they solve. But later on, people discovered that they could solve other problems with uniform continuity. But the biggest problem that uniform continuity solves is it lets us prove that continuous functions are integrable. It gives us a clear understanding of why they're integrable. And uniform convergence solves some problems where people are considering things like there were problems in physics where to solve some differential equation, you'd have to add up infinitely many trig functions, like sine of 2x plus 1/4, sine of 3x plus 1/8, sine of 4x plus 1/16, sine of 5x, and so on in that pattern. Things like that. You'd have to add up infinitely many functions and just take the point-wise sum. And what you need to understand why that'll work, at least some of the time, is you need uniform convergence to understand what's going on. Okay, so I'm showing you kind of the problems that occur if you don't introduce something like uniform convergence. And then once you introduce uniform convergence, you see that it is something that guarantees you avoid the problems. And it explains a lot of the cases where, oh, this is why we didn't have a problem. First, you've got to see that there actually are problems. Like, just like there are functions that are not Riemann integrable, uniform continuity is enough to help us avoid those problems. Uniform convergence will let us avoid problems of discontinuous limits of continuous functions and the problem of a surprised integral of a limit. So, back to the picture then. So let's attempt to draw something here. So, okay, so here would be, I'm going to have to make the y scale. I need lots of vertical spaces. Maybe take all the vertical spaces. Really get a good picture of it. Think of this as a long exposure picture. So you're going to see sort of a whole bunch of moments of time that is a whole bunch of functions kind of stacked on top of each other. Okay, so start with. So we start at 2, right? So it's G2 here. So that would be something that goes up to height 2, right? At the apex or vertex at a half. Then you have something of height 3, but that happens at a third. Then something of height 4, the peak is now at 4. That. So the peaks of the triangles are actually going to be along a hyperbola, right? The hyperbola x times y is 2. So it's going to go up rapidly now. So then the next one would be at a fifth. G5 functions. Maybe steeper. Something like that. And then you keep going, and there's a G6 function, G7 function. They're almost right on top of each other. It's really extreme. Imperfect drawing, not to scale in every regard. You can get the main idea of how it's working. So the point is when you're
way, way up here. I mean, you really like the sequence. Basically, the whole triangle is, you know, just a little bit over here. And then everywhere else beyond that, the function is zero, right? For each x in the interval, not including zero, though, for all n greater than or equal to 1 over x, right? In other words, x is, these are all positive numbers involved, right? We have x greater than or equal to 1 over n, so gn of x, or 2, sorry, I need a 2 there. For all n, and if you want to be really picky, you have to say that n has to be at least 2, right? Yeah, that's sufficiently. Does that cover it? Well, I guess I don't quite need that because 2 over x will always be at least 2. There we go. Okay. So for any x, eventually the triangles pass it by. So the pointwise limit is 0. So in terms of my super abbreviated notation, it would just be the gn's converge pointwise to the 0 function. Okay? So you have this problem now. The limit of the integrals is the limit of a is this limit of a sequence of ones. Whereas if you would perform that limit pointwise inside the integral, right? So get the limit function and then integrate that. For every point x, the limit goes to 0. I didn't cover 0 here, but for all n, gn is 0. At 0. Right, so, I mean, here I had strictly greater than 0, so I could do a reciprocal. But of course, if you're at 0, you're always at the left vertex of the triangle, so you're just 0. So point-wise, it's always 0 at 0. All the other numbers, it's eventually 0. And then this would just be the integral of 0 dx, which would just be 0. Okay, so they're not the same. You would hope that, you know, you could pull a limit outside of an integral, or equivalently pull an integral outside of the limit. But not always. Things can go bad. If you want it, you know, and there's another way things can go bad. This function, not only is this function not continuous, it's also not Riemann integrable. So we could make a little extra point there, right? Like the limit of these integrals, whether the limit of these integrals exists or not, at least these things were integrable because they could be continuous. Right? But this limit function is so horrible that it does not exist. I mean, you can't integrate it. All your upper Riemann sums would be 1. All your lower Riemann sums would be 0. So they're never going to come together getting close to a single number. So in this one, at least the integral of the limit existed, although it wasn't the right number, so to speak.
follow the ordinance of substance. So far, this has been kind of here, there be dragons. Mm-hmm. Tricky counterexamples that make it harder to safely manipulate things like combinations of limits and integrals. Or in this concept here, you know, really things like continuity. And continuity is really a limit statement, right? The limit as you approach a point C is the same as the value at C, right? So this is basically saying that, you know, two limits don't commute. So where's the safe harbor, right? Where the safe passage? That's with the uniform conversion. So give you a little analogy, right? Remember, continuity versus uniform continuity. The uniform plays essentially the same role in both modifications. You modify continuity to make it uniform. You modify convergence of a pointwise convergence to make it uniform. So the uniform means essentially the same thing in both cases. But what does this one mean? One way to state it would be for all points in the domain S there. All C and S, for all epsilon positive, there exists a delta. Now, for emphasis, I mean, when I say for every C and every epsilon there's a delta, I'm not saying that it's necessarily the same delta for each C and epsilon. So, if you want to emphasize that, you can put a little subscript there, say to indicate more explicitly that this delta might not be the same depending which C and epsilon you have. Such that for all X in the domain, that is S, if X minus C is smaller than delta, so if they're less than delta apart, then F of X minus F of C is less than epsilon apart. So you have some parameter delta that says if your delta close to C, then F of X is epsilon close to F of C. And then it's a very subtle modification to go uniform continuity. It's pretty much the same list of things, except now the delta works for all the C's. So it reads for every positive epsilon, there exists a delta. Now the delta still depends on epsilon, but it does not depend on the point C that you're looking at. So now for every point C, you can use that same delta, and now if X and C are less than delta apart, and the delta still depends on epsilon in general, but it doesn't depend on C, then F of X and F of C are less than epsilon apart. So that's all that changed, is now The delta works for all points C. You still might need to change delta if you change epsilon, but you won't need to change it if you change C. And then uniform convergence says the analogous thing for sequences. So first, we kind of expand out a definition of limit of a sequence in order to tell us what pointwise convergence means in terms of epsilons and wait times. And then we take that definition and we uniformize it. Just like here, the delta became independent of that point C. We want to have a wait time. Maybe I'll use a K for it. That's independent of the point C. Have some functions, let's say f, and then also some subscripted functions, right? And they're all functions from S to the reals. Okay, so the same domain. We say that the fn sequence converges pointwise. And we could write it this way if we want to save space. So pointwise convergence if what? So for every point C, and now just as this was an expansion of, you know, F is continuous at C into epsilon and deltas, now I have to write an expansion of the limit of Fn of C is F of C in terms of epsilons and wait times. So for every epsilon, there is a wait time k. And for emphasis, I'm going to put, I mean, it's already implied by the notation, but you know, you may not be super comfortable with the notation yet, right? So I want to emphasize that the k depends on both the point C and the epsilon. So for every point C, for every epsilon positive, real, there is a wait time k depending on C and epsilon, such that for all n at least k, fn of C is less than epsilon away from f of C. Now we can do the uniformized version. So maybe we'll write a u. Would be called uniform convergence of functions. This of course would be called pointwise convergence. So now we just move around the quantifiers as they're called. So for every positive distance epsilon, there exists a wait time that only depends on epsilon, such that for every point in the domain, starting once you've waited long enough, so starting at that k, which only depends on epsilon now, now the values of the functions are less than epsilon apart. So it's exactly the same kind of uniformization move. There's some kind of parameter for your inputs that can depend a priori on both your target level of output accuracy, epsilon, and your location, C. Your input location, C. Here, the input parameter is kind of how close you are to that input location. Here, the parameter is, the input parameter says, because the wait time, how late in the sequence do you need to be plugging in ends there in the subscript. And you can make a picture of this one. This one, j- Just like you can make a picture of sequences, the uniform one allows you to make a picture. You could rephrase this in the following nice way. For all n greater than or equal to k epsilon, you could rephrase this as the function f n minus epsilon is pointwise less than f, which is pointwise less than fn plus epsilon. So you could sort of condense this. Instead of saying this is true at every point, you could say the graphs look like this. So this you can make a picture of. So you have, you know, f here, and then you have this parameter epsilon. So everywhere you look, I draw it well. There's this common, so maybe here's fn, then I make kind of something that's supposed to be nice. You consider what happens if you would shift fn up or down by epsilon. And then we're saying that somewhere inside in that band is f. So uniform convergence gives you a lot more control,
as the picture suggests now. Because now, if you start thinking about integrals, you think about, well, what's the height theory? You know, there's a height of 2 epsilon in this band. And that means that could give you a kind of a 2 epsilon times a width control over, say, the function. So right away you can use this to understand, say, integrals. Okay. So if you have f, say you have a sequence of functions, and they're all, say, mapping from a fixed domain that's a closed interval to the reals, but and for all n, fn is bounded, and the Riemann integral fn integrated from a to b exists. So here, I want to have three statements. I guess grammatically, I say the and until the end. So if I have this and that, and the fn's converge uniformly to some function f, then we preserve Riemann integrability, and if we know what these integrals are, we can take their limit to get this integral. So this thing, right, which is a limit of, which is really, here you have a limit inside, so for emphasis, I'm going to write it this way. The limit of the fn's pointwise integrated. So this is just true by definition. Because we're saying it's a pointwise limit that happens to converge uniformly. But the interesting part is that we can actually now move the limit outside of the integrals, assuming uniform convergence. So if you know all these integrals, the limit of that sequence of numbers will be the same as the integral of this pointwise limit here. The key is that the pointwise limit is also uniform. Right? Uniform convergence implies pointwise convergence, just like uniform continuity implies continuity. Because if you have all these wait times k epsilon,
You can just use that same K epsilon for every C, right? So a uniform limit is also a pointwise limit. It's just a very nice kind of pointwise limit. So I'm going to call this a... That's the main claim here. The other claim, of course, is I want to prove, you know, that uniform limits of continuous functions are continuous. Let's do this one first, though. Okay, so a couple things here. Okay, so first, there's several claims of existence here. So not only am I saying that this integral exists, I'm saying that this limit exists, right? It's not at all clear that this limit of integrals even exists, right? I mean, a priori, a bunch of integrals, which is what I got here because I'm integrating a bunch of functions, that's just a bunch of numbers. They may not converge to anything if I list them in a sequence. Okay. It's not even obvious that the f is bounded, right? So how do I even know that this is well defined, right? Is f even bounded? Right? Well, first of all, f is bounded. This is essentially how you prove, say, that a Cauchy sequence is bounded. You know, because you have the wait time k sub 1, say, right? So using epsilon equals 1 there. So that means that, in particular, let's use the first n we can. Okay? Well, so like fk1 is one of these bounded functions. So that means that so f must map from ad to into what? Well, the minimum value of, say, the first of those that I can pick. So the minimum of really the range minus 1. Okay, technically it can be an infimum if fk1 is discontinuous. But these are both finite. So when you add the minus 1 plus 1, it stays finite. Okay. So it's bounded. So the Riemann integral makes sense. Okay? And how do we know the Riemann integral exists? Okay? Given epsilon greater than 0, choose a partition P, AB. Such that what? Well, I know that all of these functions in the sequence are integrable, so I can choose a partition that integrates one of them really well. I can only really do it one at a time, or finitely many at a time. But since I have good approximations of f by, you know, single functions, provided they're late enough in the sequence, I can get a good approximation of the integral. So the function I'll use is, say, the first one that satisfies this good approximation property here. So I'll choose one such that the difference between the upper and lower Riemann sums of, say, the function fk epsilon. Such that this difference for this partition P, we can always choose a partition P by definition remote from loop. You can choose one such that this is at most, say, why don't we actually make this not epsilon, but like half of epsilon?
Okay.
I'll do it. And the and these things will be like at most an epsilon variation. Let me just call the thing I want to subscript the k with a delta. I'll tell you what the delta is in a minute. Okay, make these at most say. How far apart can they be? Something like, let's say epsilon over 2 apart. So then I'll have epsilon over 2 more room to work with, so to speak. And for delta, what am I using here? Delta is going to play the role of epsilon in here. So I want delta to be, I think I need, let's say, epsilon over 2 times b minus a. Then the difference between the upper and lower sums of the limit function will be what? Okay. Well, you'll have this delta now, right there. Let me make it over 4. Okay. So we have this picture now of, let me write the equation first and then draw the picture. So we'll have this difference just from the, you know, the quality of the approximation of f sub k sub delta. But then how much worse could things get? Well, the idea is, the upper sum of f is going to be at most delta more. So add a delta here. Right? And that's as high as it could get. And then subtract a delta for giving the worst case scenario of how bad the lower sum could get. Okay. Squeeze it over. So kind of the picture here is we've got a good partition for f sub k. It's pretty good. So think of it in terms of like stair steps above and below, okay? All right, and then here's kind of the upper stair steps. So the kind of the error, so to speak, in the approximation, right, is this area in here, in those boxes. I get that area less than epsilon over 2. And then I'm worried about my function f. But what I do is I constrain f to be at most, you know, delta above or delta below. You have something like this, say. So the function f is somewhere in there. Yeah. And now, how much worse could things get? Right. Well, you could imagine, these boxes each getting. Getting an extra delta on each end. It's kind of the worst case scenario you could imagine. Is somehow f really kisses the upper and lower envelope essentially everywhere somehow. So it's really as bad as this. roughly like that.
And the picture's not perfect.
So you would, you know, you'd be losing about, there's like two delta of height of additional possible trouble. And we're and then we're multiplying it by a width of D over A. So this thing here,
just kind of the worst case thing.
This will be at most the original trouble, which is an epsilon over 2 in area, plus an additional delta of height in each direction. So that will be 2 delta. And in area, that would add up to just the width of the whole interval, B minus A. So that's why I chose the delta to be this funny thing, to make 2 delta of height times B minus A of width just be another epsilon over 2. So uniform convergence lets you actually get good approximations of functions in a kind of very strong graphical sense here, which means that it's a good approximation in an area sense too. So any function late enough in the sequence, if you have a good partition, say epsilon over 2 good, for Riemann integral, then you can use that to have, again, assuming it's a function late enough in the sequence, you can have a only slightly worse approximation of f using the same partition. And that's all you need to prove Riemann integrability. You just need a partition that is epsilon good. Right? For each epsilon, you have to come up with such a thing. So I think I'll have to write up the proof of continuity, because it's going to take all the remaining minute or two that I have to finish this proof. The proof of continuity being preserved by uniform convergence, instead of, you know, like an epsilon over 4 B minus A, it's like it's an epsilon over 3 argument. You have to kind of break up something into 3 parts and make each part smaller than epsilon over 3, which you can do using uniform convergence and continuity of the functions in the sequence, and then get something that's at most epsilon apart in total to prove continuity of the limit function. So that proof's not too hard. I mean, at least no harder than this proof. I think it's probably easier than this proof. I'll wrap up this proof. Type up the other one, post it to Angel as soon as I can. Of course, these facts are very well known. So you can read the proofs in any standard book on analysis. Okay, so we've just shown that the integral at least exists. When you take the point, when you take a uniform limit. Now, the other thing I want to show is that I can take the integrals of the functions in the sequence now, and that the resulting sequence of integrals will actually be a convergent sequence with limit equal to the integral f. The integral of f, which is the integral of the pointwise limits there. Again, assuming it's a uniform kind of pointwise limit. So, that's the last thing. It doesn't take very long now. So,
again, this is the kind of thing where, given an epsilon, you want to show that some stuff gets epsilon together, epsilon close together. In this case, it's a sequence, so we need to show that we need to find, say, m, right? Some wait time m, such that for all n, at least m, the integral of f n dx minus the integral of f of x dx of the same interval is smaller than epsilon. So we just have to show that the sequence is eventually epsilon close to this integral that we just showed exists. And it's essentially the same argument, right? You just know that good vertical control multiplied by a finite fixed width gives you good area control. So it's really easy. What's the m going to be? I claim that in terms of those wait times k's for the uniform convergence, you can just let m be the k corresponding to... you could use the same delta here, although you don't need the division by 4 anymore. Just divide by the width. Okay. That's it. Just need the fact that you can combine them. Integrals are linear. So we may need to actually prove this may not have been proved yet, but it is true. If two functions are integrable, then you can add or subtract them inside the integral. Skipping a step here, but the point is, because you have these bounds, just like we argued over here, the lower and upper sums then will also be controlled by these bounds. So maybe the strict less than becomes just less than or equal to in the limit, but it can't flip direction. So. And this constant shifting will just bring the integral down by epsilon over b minus a times width. And that's all there is to it. And then you just have to check, very easily thing that even if you're not sure about proving about adding any two functions together, you shouldn't have any trouble convincing yourself that if you add a constant to a function, that's just going to shift up all of the lower and upper Riemann sums by a constant, by that constant times the width. So this is just the integral here plus epsilon over b minus a times the width b minus a. So you have the same thing again. The point is to cancel out the width. Sorry. Somebody want to ask me something?
So hurry a little bit again. Okay. And that's it. So you've got it. That's supposed to be a minus. Okay. So this minus epsilon is less than or equal to this, which is less than or equal to this, plus an epsilon. So indeed, they're less than epsilon. And that's all there is to the proof. We've shown that the limit of the sequence of integrals exists and equals the integral of the limit. And we had earlier shown that the limit function, right, was bounded, and then we showed it was integrable. Okay, you might be a little annoyed here because it's a less than or equal to. If you're not happy about that, you know, you can go all the way back and make this an epsilon over 2 here, and then get epsilons over 2s everywhere. So if I just picked maybe a slightly higher k, perhaps, or you know, if I just made this a teensy bit smaller, right? Say I could have gotten, say, epsilon over 2, and that would be strictly less than epsilon. So that's the end, and I'll write up the proof about continuity, and then we'll talk about applying these ideas to power series and to derivatives next time. So that will be next Monday. And I'll also tell you what the homework is, but I'll just send out the homework is in email tonight, okay? So I can let you go now. So over time.